There are many who may consider Canada to be a safe haven for immigrants wishing to start a new life there. Yet horrible things happening to the black community, the people of First Nation and non-white immigrants indicate a fact that although people can live there freely, it can never be equal to white Canadians. International rights organizations have reported an array of violations in Canada, including rights of Indigenous people, violence against Indigenous women and girls, children in immigration detention, mining industry abuses, and sexual orientation, as well as gender identity. Stay with us for a debate on that issue.
Canada has always been considered a safe haven for immigrants who come from across the world to start a new life in the Northern American country. But many believe that the terrible things that happened to the black community of Canada, the people of First Nation and non-white immigrants, suggest that although they can live freely in Canada, they can never be equal to white Canadians.
There's no systemic discrimination. There's no system in Quebec.
Thank God that we're different than the United States.
But experts believe that Canada has been actually founded on systemic discrimination, and the authorities' denial is part of the systemic racism. They say Canada's society has been made based on white supremacy. Systemic racism means normalizing racism. Non-white Canadians say they face systemic racism on an almost daily basis.
This country was founded on systemic discrimination.
The Canadian government says that Canada is radically different from the U.S. when it comes to racism. But the truth is, both countries have been founded on stolen and colonized lands. Both countries have attempted genocide on Indigenous people. And both countries have a dark history in slavery. And now, decades later, non-white and Indigenous communities of Canada are still struggling with police brutality. This attitude has also resulted in an increase in the number of hate crimes against non-white population of Canada. Joyce Achakuan heard racist and degrading comments from healthcare workers at a hospital in Montreal only moments before her death in September. She was one of the thousands of women who faced maltreatment because of her ethnicity. Canada has been coming to terms with racial injustice suffered by its Indigenous people in recent years. In 2019, a government inquiry found that Canada was complicit in, quote, race-based genocide against Indigenous women. The report said Indigenous women were 12 times more likely to be killed or disappear than other women in Canada. The inquiry said the cause was the deep-rooted colonialism and state inaction. It also found that persistent and deliberate human and Indigenous rights violations and abuses are the root cause behind Canada's staggering rates of violence. The Canadian government has repeatedly pledged to address these issues. But to this day, the number of racially motivated abuses still continues to rise.
Well, we got a couple of guests from Canada to discuss this. Joining me will be Chair of the Community Coalition Against Racism in Hamilton, Ken Stone, who's joining us out of Hamilton, Ontario. We also have author and columnist Robert Fantina out of Kitchener, Ontario. Good to have both of you, gentlemen, on the show. Let's go to Ken. Major human rights organizations report serious rights violations in Canada. They include wide-ranging abuses against Indigenous people, the continued confinement of immigration detainees in jails, a prison law that does not rule out prolonged solitary confinement, the overseas operations of Canadian extractive companies, and on top of all of these, a growing number of Indigenous women and girls either going missing or being murdered. Can you educate us some more details about the human rights situation in Canada?
The Canadian government and the colonial empires that ran Canada before Confederation were based on a racist and capitalist colonization of North America, in which Native people were considered as subhuman, and they were, from the very first contact, killed on the spot. They were ethnically cleansed, sometimes they were captured and made as household slaves. Later they were marginalized. Sometimes they were pressed into becoming the foot soldiers of one empire, the French or the British, against the other. They were used as workers in the colonial fur trade empires. They were finally marginalized onto reservations with their lands taken away from them, their cultures destroyed. And what you see today is the result of 500 years of exploitation. It's not just Native people. As you correctly pointed out in the intro to this program, immigrants from all parts of the world have suffered racism in Canada. The Japanese were interned in World War II. The Chinese were subject to a head tax. The Sikhs were not prohibited to immigrate. The Jews were not given the safe passage or allowed to come into the country to free Nazi Germany. The Orange Order was founded. It was continued here to keep the Irish down. It goes on and on. Racism has played a large role in Canada because the powers that be use it to exploit various groups at the lowest wages they can and to turn groups against each other. And that's why we say that people who have suffered from racism need to unite with other people who have suffered from racism and discrimination and change this society fundamentally, right down to the roots of who holds power and why.
Right. Let me ask Robert this question. Robert, Indigenous women are 12 times more likely to be killed or disappeared than other women in Canada. And this is based on government inquiry last year that found Canada complicit in race-based genocide against Indigenous women. Where does this emanate from?
I think there are a couple of sources. One is that, as Mr. Stone said, Canada was based on, Canada is a colonial nation. It's occupying Indigenous people's lands. It continues to and has for, of course, centuries. And that's this marginalization of the Indigenous women and men and children, too, is all part of that. Now, we have what's been referred to as missing white women syndrome. If a white woman goes missing, it's major news. Her picture is on all the news outlets. Tearful requests for her return are presented on the news programs. However, if a non-white woman is missing, it's not the case, because society has said they aren't as important, that women of color are simply not equal to women to white women. And this is a long-standing tradition, that may not be the right word, but it's built into the fabric of the country, because the country was founded on the genocide of the people who lived here for centuries. And mm-hmm. they've been pushed onto reservations, they've been marginalized, they live in terrible conditions, and this continues because it serves the needs of the white power structure. And mm-hmm. until that changes, nothing else is going to change for the people who are suffering.
Right. Now, Robert says that Canada was founded on genocide. There are also some experts arguing that Canada was also founded on a systemic discrimination and white superiority. What's your opinion?
Absolutely. The people who founded what is now Canada, that is to say, the people who took over and colonized what is now Canada, the British and the French mainly, had the view, the British had the view that they had a white man's burden to lift up the native people and bring them up to the standard, their standards. Of course, they never did that. The French had the mission of civilization, the mission civilatrice, where they would bring the poor heathens into the Roman Catholic religion and teach them the right way. These were just the cover stories for their systemic racism. They had no intention of ever bringing these people into full participation in society. And in fact, in some cases, such as in Newfoundland, the British colonial government there participated in the extermination of the Beothuks, which is a shameful chapter in Canadian history. Canadian society, right until this day, it's a class society, and the people who are at the top of the class are mainly white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant males, and they seek to maintain their domination through a system of policing, laws, jails, denial of opportunities for education, medical care, housing, and every other aspect of society you can think of to the people at the bottom, and who are largely native. But there's also people who are at the bottom who are of color, people who are black, new immigrants. They are all put through the mill. And it's a self-perpetuating system whereby the people at the top use the racism to turn white people against people of color and people of other ethnic origins and native people. And for years, for centuries, this has gone on. But there has been a growing anti-racist movement and a growing movement of solidarity with native people that is pulling together people from all these groups and demanding equality and justice and restorative justice for the native people, especially, who have lost their lands, their culture, their health, their dignity, who had their children taken away from them in the residential school system. A lot of their Canada, as you said, has made strides in the last number of years in trying to restore, have some kind of accounting and change. And we have to applaud the people who have done that, and the certain changes in government where they've paid out land claims, they've paid compensation for the residential schools, they've made apologies, they've had royal commissions without an end. Unfortunately, you could paper your house with all the recommendations from those piles and piles of royal commission reports that have never been implemented. Nonetheless, the struggle continues, and it's the duty of all Canadians, whatever color, to help to support the native people in their struggles, such as the one that's taking place just a few miles from where I'm sitting, where the 1492 Land Back Group is taking back a piece of land on which a developer wished to make a new subdivision. I had the pleasure of joining with a trade union delegation of solidarity that went to see them and bring them supplies the other day. That's the kind of thing that Canadians have to do.
Right. Now, Robert, the Ottawa government is saying that Canada is radically different from the United States when it comes to racism. Do you agree? Could you kind of draw a comparison between the two?
Canada seems to paper it over a little bit more carefully, but the racism is still there. This is seen in some of the statistics that you mentioned earlier regarding the disappearances and deaths of Indigenous women. Also, the United Nations Proclamation on the Rights of Indigenous People was passed, and earlier this year, a bill was introduced into the Canadian Parliament to bring standards up to that, and it did not pass. So this is, again, where an attempt was made to try to bring things more equal, try to end the racism, and it failed, which is something that one would expect in the United States. But Canada has this image of not being racist. But we look at the same kinds of situations. We look at the number of non-whites who are in solitary confinement. We look at the number of immigrants who are caged. In the U.S., for a time, that was there was outrage against that, but that passed. It's old news that it's still happening. But it continues to happen. It happens also, perhaps to a lesser degree, but also in Canada. There's other systemic racism. It is part and parcel of the establishment of the nation of Canada, the same way it was part of the establishment of the nation of the United States. It's endemic in its society and in its makeup, and changing it is not going to be easy, but it must be done.
Right. Canada government, as you know, has repeatedly promised to deal with, you know, such issues that we're talking about. It's also pledged a long-awaited national inquiry on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, but it has failed to do so. Why is that the case?
It's not a priority for the government. As the Mr. Fantino said in previous comment, the Canadian government doesn't live up to its international obligations concerning Indigenous peoples, and it doesn't live up to even its own promises of what it will do to help Native people in Canada. And one of those is the missing and murdered Indigenous women. The commission has gone on for years. I don't see any radical changes about to take place, and I'm afraid probably that any recommendations will probably end up on the shelf gathering dust, along with the other royal commissions that have taken place over the last 40 or 50 years. So I think that it's up to ordinary Canadians to take a stand here, to become active in their communities, and to take a positive role in fighting racism. I think that, in fact, that's the only way that things change in Canada, is when there's a grassroots pressure on the government to do something. For example, in this particular, in the case of pipelines, when the government wanted to put a pipeline through the Wet'suwet'en lands, and people took to the streets, and people blocked roads, people blocked highways and railway tracks.
Right.
That forces the government to come to terms. And even now in Caledonia, just a few miles from here, where the 1492 Land Act has been holding out for a couple of months now, despite arrests, being shot at with rubber bullets, being beaten by police, they're holding out, and now there's talk that the federal and provincial governments may sit down to negotiate something, which is something they should have done at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. In fact, they never even bothered to consult the traditional leadership of the Haudenosaunee people, that is to say, the leadership, the traditional chiefs of the Six Nations,
right,
who have been sitting on the, you know, brought into Canada and settled here as a result of the American Revolutionary War around 1784. So they've been here over 200 years on that land, and that land has been taken away from them progressively, year chunk by chunk, year by year. Now they want some of it back, and they're going to get it.
Mm-hmm. Now, Robert, Canada is also continuously exporting military equipment and weapons to countries with a record of human rights violations. Can you tell us something about this?
Yes, this is another violation of human rights that's a stain on Canada's record. Canada does export weapons, does sell weapons to anyone who wants to buy them, and this is in the U.S. model, certainly. It's certainly lucrative for the government, and it brings in quite a bit of revenue, but it is still in violation of international law. These other countries should not be receiving weapons unless and until they can bring their human rights practices up to at least a minimum standard, which they don't do. The Canadian government must immediately stop these sales. It's a violation of human rights within Canada because it violates Canadian law, but also it fosters the violation of human rights by these other countries. They continue to oppress their people, to kill their people and other people. So it's as if Canada is pulling the trigger and dropping the bombs themselves by providing this weaponry. This is another thing that needs to stop, and that is the Canadian government seems to hide sometimes. It's not clearly recognized how much weaponry that Canada does sell to other countries and who it sells it to. But if this were known, Canada would lose its undeserved reputation as a peacemaker and as a country that fosters diplomacy and justice. These are myths, unfortunately, that the government has fostered, but the reality is simply not the case.
Well, Canada, we'll come to the end of this debate. Let me thank our guests. We had Chair of the Community Coalition Against Racism in Hamilton, Ken Stone, who joined us from Hamilton, Ontario, and author and journalist Robert Fentina out of Kitchener, Ontario. Then your host, Fehruz Najah.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Jafar Sobhani. Please stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala khayri khalqihi wa alihi at-tahirin.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Praise be to Allah, the Lord of the worlds, and may His peace and blessings be upon the best of His creation, Prophet Muhammad, and his pure progeny. Some ignorant people of our society are under the impression, due to misguiding propaganda, that the secret of success in the field of industry attained by the West is due to their distance from religion and morality. They imagine that the reason of West superiority over the East is due to dancing, singing, and the nudity of their women. Owing to their sense of inferiority, some such people want to become like the Westerners by copying their dress and adopting their attires. They fail to understand that it is the style of an industrialized society. The foundation of their progress is knowledge and research. The base of their civilization is that they are not subservient to any superpower. They are standing on their own feet as independent nations and are constantly occupied in scientific research. Here it is befitting to remember Iqbal Lahori's lofty thoughts and show our gratitude to him by quoting some of his couplets, which are full of wisdom. The blind imitation of the West makes the East forget its position. In fact, the Eastern nations should have criticized the dancing of the veilless women. The strength of the West is neither owing to the colorful faces of the girls, nor due to their bare legs, nor it has sprung from their haircuts. The stability of the West is also not Latin script. There is no relation between power, hat, suit, and Latin script. Eastern headdress never comes in the way of science and literature. The strength of the Ferengis or the Westerners is due to science and industry. Their lamp is burning with the knowledge and industry. all witty and senseless use. You must concentrate on knowledge, not on the dress of the Westerner. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Jafar Sobhani. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care, and goodbye.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Deen al-Islam, deen al-Islam, deen al-Islam, Muhammad il-Hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Today we're going to talk about gambling, but before dealing with the issues and the laws concerning gambling, according to Ayatollah Sistani, let's take a listen to a short biography about him.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ashraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazvini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in Fiqh and Usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence, and the Fundamentals of Jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Shifter, since we are talking about gambling and the issues related to that, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Sistani, PUBG is becoming very popular among kids and children in many parts of the world. What is the religious position of Ayatollah Sistani about that?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. His position regarding PUBG is the same as that of Clash of Clans.
Mm-hmm.
In regards to Clash of Clans, Ayatollah Sistani says that, okay, it's not permissible to sell it, to sell the game, okay, or to earn any money by through selling it. But as far as playing it is concerned, his muqallidin can refer to another mujtahid and follow that mujtahid, the next most learned mujtahid. The same is true with PUBG. Of course, it's a new game that is becoming more and more popular in the world, and of course, it is an online game that is played by people, by teens, and of course, it's not a means for gambling. But Ayatollah Sistani says that that people who want to play it, they can refer to the next most learned mujtahid. Al-A'lam fal-A'lam. Okay, the most learned, the next most learned mujtahid.
Mm-hmm.
And he has not expressed his opinion about whether PUBG is forbidden or not. Of course, a lot of people ask questions. They are trying to solicit Ayatollah Sistani's response to PUBG and to see what he looks at PUBG and whether he considers it as forbidden or is permissible or impermissible.
Mm-hmm.
Ayatollah Sistani does not express his opinion regarding PUBG. He says his muqallidin can follow the next most learned mujtahid. So it seems that he is actually exercising precaution, because it's only in matters of precaution that he refers his muqallidin to another mujtahid. He tells them to follow the next most learned mujtahid. If he had a fatwa, he would not have kept it as a secret, okay? He would disclose it to his followers.
Mm-hmm.
But since the nature of some games,
yes,
are not actually known to Ayatollah Sistani, like Clash of Clans and also PUBG,
mm-hmm.
This is my understanding of the situation. He does not have a clear picture of these games. That's why for the time being he has not issued his fatwa, and he is asking his followers to follow the next most learned mujtahid who may have a fatwa, and who has a fatwa actually.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, if he does not have a fatwa, they should exercise precaution. They should not play it for the time being.
Mm-hmm. Generally people for fun, when they find a free time, they play different kinds of games, you know.
Yes.
And you talked about, in fact, religious laws and Islamic laws issued by Ayatollah Sistani about some of these games that we talked about in this episode or the previous ones, such as billiards, for example, or Clash of Clans or card games.
Yes.
And you also expressed Ayatollah Sistani's fatwas on them. But what about dominoes?
Dominoes, Ayatollah Sistani says that it's not permissible to play it as an obligatory precaution.
Mm-hmm.
So, al-ahwati wujuban. He has exercised obligatory precaution, and he says it's not permissible to play it as a measure of obligatory precaution. So the fatwa is clear. It's not permissible.
I see. What is
as
the
an obligatory precaution? Yes.
What is the criterion, Sheikh Tawi, to differentiate the kinds of games which are used for or as a means for gambling or not used as means for gambling?
Well, Ayatollah Sistani says that we have to look at the public opinion about a game. If in a city or in a township, most of the people consider a game to be a means for gambling, so that game is a means for gambling, okay? And if a small number of people believe or consider that special game to be a means for gambling, it does not make it a means for gambling, okay?
Yes.
So we have to look at the majority of the people, majority of the mu'minin, not majority of non-mu'minin, okay? Because when we look at the public opinion, we should always look at the opinion of the Muslims, not non-Muslims. And Muslims who are faithful, who are practicing Muslims, not ordinary people who do
or
not,
lay people.
Yeah, who are very carefree and who do not
care about religion.
Yeah, who do not care about religion. So the custom of believers is the criterion, and if most of the believers consider a game to be a means for gambling, then we should not play it. We should not play it, and it's not permissible to play it as an obligatory precaution. Okay, of course, if there are few people believing or considering it as a means for gambling, then that does not make it as a means for gambling. So it could be permissible. And let me tell you that it's not true to say that all games are forbidden according to Ayatollah Sistani, whether they are means for gambling or not, whether they are used for gambling or not. No. There are some games that can be played, okay, if they are not considered to be means for gambling. So it's permissible to play them.
Yes.
The office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Even if you mean that, you know, some of them are considered gambling.
Means for gambling.
So the games, in fact, are used for gambling, so they are religiously unlawful.
Yes.
Islamically unlawful. Even if despite the fact that there is a kind of, department supporting it, or there is a tournament, there is an Olympic for it, something like that, and they use it as a kind of, even the public opinion, as you said, of course, I'm not talking about the mu'minin only, but the common sense, the public opinion, the people generally believe it as a kind of mental sport.
That does not make it allowable or permissible, okay?
Yes.
What makes it permissible is that if the majority of mu'minin do not consider it as a means for gambling, then it becomes permissible. There's no problem in playing it, okay? And provided that it's not, there's no betting in it, because betting is haram. even if you are betting through a game which is not considered to be a means for gambling, you are, for example, there's an unknown game you are playing, and the mu'minin have no information about that game. They do not have any sense of what that game is, and they do not have any image of that game, and so they cannot give and come and to tell you, to give you their opinion about that game. Mm-hmm. But if it involves betting, it's not permissible to play it.
Uh-huh, okay? I see.
And therefore, I would like to say that some games, according to Ayatollah Sistani, may be permissible. They are neither considered a means for gambling, and there's no betting involved, there's no money involved, and you can play it just for fun. And Ayatollah Sistani is not opposed to playing a game for fun. You see, if you are playing it, there's no money involved, no betting involved, okay? And it's the game is not also considered to be a means for gambling, there's no objection.
Mm-hmm.
This is what you can infer from his fatwas, even on his website. If you go through, there are special, parts in the question answer section you can find, and you can go through, you will come to know that this is his position.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
With Christmas right around the corner, retailers can only hope and pray the November lockdown is not extended beyond December 2nd. After the severe blow dealt it by the first lockdown, the British economy bounced back by 15.5% in the July to September period. But the worry is that it will shrink again over the winter months. Weak household spending is being blamed for the UK's poor GDP performances.
The unemployment rate in the UK is continuing to surge, and redundancy rates are at an all-time high. Millions of Britons are struggling to make ends meet, and millions more are saving their pennies for even rainier days.
I'm quite happy with what the Chancellor has done. Of course, everybody is, and everybody won't be when they talk about how to get these monies back. I mean, he's talked about cutting duty-free. People are complaining about that.
Concerned, very concerned about the younger people in particular, because of unemployment, because of the huge debt there's going to be. It's a massive, massive worry. And I don't think we've seen how bad it's going to be yet.
Yeah. I think the situation with Brexit is a complete shambles. You know, the government doesn't seem to have a grip on it, just as it doesn't seem to have a grip on the COVID epidemic. I mean, it's terribly worrying. I mean, I've got two sons, both who work in hospitality, and they're worried stiff about what's going to happen.
The extension of the furlough scheme might help encourage spending. The government will now be paying 80% of the salaries of workers retained by firms rather than fired until March. Britain's manufacturing sector will be getting a massive tax break extension as well. But according to the Bank of England, things will get worse before they get better. It predicts the UK's GDP could shrink by 2% in the October-December quarter, and its economy is likely to shrink by a record 11% in 2020, before growing by just 7% in 2021. But did the UK have this coming despite COVID-19?
The present situation started a year ago, last September,
when the banks began to refuse to lend money to each other, and there was a panic in the banking system. Now, that is always the first sign of a coming huge economic collapse. It always happens about a year or two before the actual collapse. The debt levels have built up to be completely unrepayable. The rich-poor division has increased, and the type of jobs coming into existence due to the technological shift are now temporary and part-time.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Director of Communications, Lee Kane, has quit, and now his top advisor, Dominic Cummings, has left as well. Some say this will make for smoother Brexit talks, due to resume this week before an EU summit on Thursday. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The British Labour Party has found itself entangled in yet another racism crisis after a new report found huge levels of Islamophobia within the party. The report, commissioned by the newly formed Labour Muslim Network, suggests that current party leader Sir Keir Starmer has greatly lost the trust of his party's Muslim members. Just some of the damning results claim that
more than one in four Muslim members and supporters have experienced Islamophobia within party ranks. 59% say they do not feel well represented by the leadership. 55% claim they don't even trust the leadership to tackle Islamophobia effectively, while 46% feel the party doesn't represent the community effectively.
In response to the report, I reached out to British Muslims who have already decided to quit the party to ask why they felt they had to leave.
And from the people I've met, the counsellors I've experienced, the talking I've had, conversations, prior to even Keir Starmer's appointment, there was a problem within the Labour Party. Once he came into his position, it just reinforced everything that we were already saying that is happening and existing. And this was the reason for my exodus and the large exodus by my community.
The report, which interviewed hundreds of British Muslim members, added that some key policy issues create hurt amongst Muslims, including its stance on Israeli crimes in Palestine and Starmer's U-turn on Labour's Kashmir policy earlier this year.
Leave the Labour Party, cut off your cards, and let your friends and family know that this is what's happening, and Keir Starmer shouldn't be able to silently still get our vote and then still implement these ways. Labour is a failed system. Labour is a crumbling system, and Labour is not something that will represent us as British Muslims who live in the UK now. You know, it's just not. And Keir Starmer, I would sincerely hope that you would consider your position on the Kashmir issue.
Before Starmer took over, the party was rocked by the anti-Semitism crisis for many years. Some even argue it's what brought down the previous leadership. But the question is, will the response be the same to this blatant crisis of Islamophobia within the party? Many are arguing not. Robert Carter, London.
Once again, the violent clashes. The police tear gassed protesters to disperse them in Pakistan's garrison city of Rawalpindi near capital Islamabad. Nonetheless, a massive crowd emerged on the streets despite chilly weather conditions. At the heart of an intense public anger is the display of a blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet of the Islam by the French government on state-run buildings last month. Since then, there has been no let-up to the protest like this in Pakistan. The frequent publications, newspapers, and public display of anti-Islamic blasphemous cartoons have ignited an unprecedented scale of public resentment against France and its citizens in Pakistan. Protesters vowed to avenge the blasphemers of the Prophet of the Islam.
The honor of our Prophet is being insulted by the President of France. We demand the government official to kick out the ambassador of France right now from the Pakistan. Otherwise, these all people will protest. We will march in millions towards the towards the embassy of France, we will march in millions, inshallah.
Being here in this weather, in this condition, against the government of France, against the officials, who they are not kicking the France ambassador from the Pakistan, why we are here? To protect our respect of our holy prophet Muhammad Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. No one can stop us to protect the our own religion, over the respect of our holy prophet Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam.
Pakistan's mainstream media largely opted to black out the coverage of this protest, allegedly under pressure to contain the agitation on this most sensitive issue. The organizers complain that their large number of protesters were arrested to prevent them to participate in the gathering. The government suspended all cell phone services and blocked all major highways to prevent the entry of angry protesters in the capital city. The extraordinary security measures have been undertaken to avert the repetition of violent clashes happened not far from French embassy in Islamabad in early this month. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
It seems the growing number of coronavirus infections and death has not yet sounded the alarm in Turkey's government offices to impose another lockdown in the country. The reluctance comes amid reports that the flow of tourists is still going strong in Turkey amid the pandemic, especially in its largest city of Istanbul, which has not only the highest number of tourists, but also the highest number of coronavirus infections and death. The city counts for about 40% of confirmed infected cases in Turkey. This number forced the mayor of Istanbul, Ekrem İmamoğlu, to call on the government to impose a total lockdown in the city for at least 2 to 3 weeks. However, his call was rejected.
When we look at the current data, it is obvious that a lockdown is absolutely necessary. I have shared this issue with all the authorities and people of Istanbul. I think a 2 to 3 week lockdown is necessary. This is highly advised by our scientists and experts.
Many believe that the government's decision is deeply rooted in its economic concerns. The government officials maintain that the closure of restaurants and public places at 10 p.m., along with social distancing and wearing masks, is enough to contain the virus.
The second wave of the coronavirus is spreading all over the world, and the situation is getting worse. Many governments may consider lockdown as an effective way to cope with the pandemic, but lockdown has its own consequences. Many people will lose their jobs, and it seems the Turkish government is now mainly concerned with the economic aspects of the lockdown.
Turkey's Cultural and Tourism Ministry announced last week that since the end of the last lockdown several months ago, the country has had 9.46 million visitors from various countries, including European ones, where the pandemic has hit the most. Those arriving to Turkey are not even being tested, which makes the spread of the virus even easier. Many here say Turkish government is favoring economy over public health. Now, the main question is how far the government may remain reluctant to meet the growing demands for lockdown as the country's coronavirus infections and death are getting out of control. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
The Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela has strongly rejected a round of one-year-long sanctions fired by the European Union, which challenges the legitimacy of the upcoming legislative elections in the Latin American nation. Nicolas Maduro made the remarks after the EU's European Council condemned a decision by the Supreme Court of Venezuela to reshuffle the composition of the country's National Electoral Council. Maduro said the move by the European body is influenced by the regime change policy of the United States, which refuses to recognize Maduro's presidency and the country's legal institutions. The Venezuelan head of state said the elections will take place despite the economic sanctions because they follow the rule of the national constitution. Officials totally back Maduro's statement.
The EU sanctions are a violation of international law, and therefore we absolutely repudiate them.
From a different perspective, many opposition members justify the EU policy.
From a different perspective, many opposition members justify the EU policy. However, experts say the EU sanctions are unfounded and influenced by Washington.
The EU is mistaken in politically following the US meddlesome policy. The truth is, most political parties are running in these legislative elections.
Despite the aggression by the EU, the government of Venezuela says Maduro will go on as the country's president, and parliamentary elections will be held this year because Venezuela is a free country and it won't be brought to its knees by foreign sanctions. Jesus Silva Caracas.
In a somber silence, France marked 5 years since the November 15 attacks. 130 people were killed in what is the country's deadliest peacetime attack. Takfiri extremists linked to Daesh claimed responsibility for the attack as a response to France's military involvement in Syria and Iraq. Prime Minister Jean Castex led the commemorations as France finds itself in the midst of more Takfiri extremism and growing Islamophobia, polarizing the population. In the past few weeks, Takfiri extremists have killed 4 people after a series of Islamophobic statements from President Emmanuel Macron, as well as the overt promotion of blasphemous cartoons of Prophet Muhammad. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan also condemned Macron's rhetoric.
Mekke, Medine,
it is an issue of honor for us to stand against the attacks against our Prophet who honored the entire world. The West are once again heading for a period of barbarity. France and Europe in general, they don't deserve the policies of Macron and those with similar mindsets that spread seeds of hate.
French Muslim leaders have condemned all forms of violence and have called for restraint. France is also calling for a crackdown of foreign funding that it says stokes extremist sentiments. But wide-ranging condemnation of the entire Muslim community by politicians has only deepened divisions. Yesterday, France hosted the Paris Peace Forum, where leaders discussed the ongoing threat of extremism.
No one can say when the pandemic will stop, nor when terrorism will be vanquished. So we cannot wait. We must lead the fight back and build structures that will allow us to better foresee these global threats.
The 2015 attacks shocked the world and damaged relations between communities. President Macron has since tried to dampen emotions, but France remains at a crossroads. Any further Islamophobic sentiments will only flame the tensions.
Trump and his fellow Republicans keep insisting that the U.S. presidential election was rigged, calling for a recount of ballots in several key states. Trump and his team have filed several lawsuits contesting the outcome of the election. However, they have suffered legal setbacks in 3 battleground states, namely Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Arizona. Courts there rejected Republicans' call for probing the vote count process and blocking mail-in ballots. Meanwhile, U.S. prosecutors have asked Attorney General William Barr to rescind a memo that instructed them to publicly investigate allegations of vote counting irregularities. The prosecutors say they have not seen any unusual activity. Barr sent his memo after days of attacks on the integrity of the election by President Donald Trump and his Republican allies. Although Trump has refused to concede defeat, he said in recent remarks that time will tell which administration will take office in the White House in January.
Whatever happens in the future, who knows which administration it will be? I guess time will tell.
The remarks are the first indication that Trump could concede defeat in the disputed November 3rd presidential election. Still, some of Trump's supporters, as well as his fellow Republicans, are refusing to budge and remain hopeful that their candidate still has the chance to become the next president. The controversy over the election results comes against the backdrop of pro- and anti-Trump demonstrations. Trump supporters back his vote-rigging claims, while his opponents are happy with the projected victory of Joe Biden. Nevertheless, experts believe the nature of the U.S. regime will not change no matter who takes the reins at the White House.
What we're seeing is that
the people who control both parties, the Democrats and Republicans, they want Trump out. You know, Trump is not perfect by any means. He's actually really bad for the American people. But the one thing that we can all give him credit is that he exposed the reality of the U.S. empire. He showed just how brutal it is. And I think for a lot of people on Wall Street and Washington who want to rebrand U.S. empire, Trump is too dangerous, and it's looking every day like Trump may be forced to concede.
Now, it remains to be seen who will be confirmed in office as the next U.S. president, and whether or not there will be any major policy changes in the new administration.